areas, and the second only involved rubbing of the alleged victim's breast. And so in this case, there would be no instruction to the jury that the jury does not have to be unanimous on which allegations they find true and are finding guilt.
Okay, so you would cabin your argument to this kind of sexual assault charge only?
That's correct. Sufficient notice must be provided in every sexual assault of a child case, or every case, actually. But in this case, when we're only talking about one or two distinct acts, there isn't the finding by the jury that they don't have to be unanimous on which acts are found.
Counsel, one of the things that impressed me about the Court of Appeals decision was that the Court of Appeals looked very carefully at whether or not this particular victim could give specific details in regard to these two allegations. And the Court of Appeals was satisfied that because there were specific details given in regard to each offense, that clearly there was notice for the defendant. And not only that, there wasn't any danger of a violation ultimately of being charged again with similar offenses. How do you get around that? I thought it was a very carefully worded decision.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that the Court of Appeals actually had a misapplication of the factors as held in Fawcett and RER. Specifically, the Court of Appeals, in discussing Factor 7, which is the particularization of the date and time of the offense, they went into detail as to what the nature of the offense was or what details she could provide concerning what type of action was taken as opposed to the date and time. And what we're really looking at here when we talk about notice and sufficiency so that a defendant may prepare a defense is whether the charging period is overly broad, not the specificity of the specific claim of the conduct.
Could you explain to me, as a defense counsel, on facts like this case, why is it important to defense counsel and to the defendant to have sufficient notice of a date? It's really, explain it.
Well, I think, first of all, a defendant's due process rights are violated if sufficient notice isn't applied. And what we're talking about here is a case where we have a charging period that is 15 years and 12 years prior to when the complaint is filed. And so what we lose when there's not sufficient notice as to a particular date or time, and we're not alleging that it would only have to be one date because time doesn't have to be alleged with precision, but a more narrowly tailored charging period, we're not going to be able to compile any business records that may still exist. If, in fact, they do, most businesses will get rid of some records after 5 or 10 years. What we're also considering is whether there would be a potential alibi defense. For instance, in this case, in the second count, she was able to allege that it happened before 4:30 because that's when she would wake her stepfather up. What we don't have is whether it was a weekday or a weekend. She put it in terms of being in the sixth grade, but we don't know whether it was while she was in school or whether it was in the summer session. And so as the defense counsel, those are all important considerations. And without that, with this overly broad charging period, we're not able to craft and prepare a defense that I believe would be constitutionally sufficient based on the notice provided.
I don't understand the business records in a situation like this. And frankly, I don't understand the alibi. We're talking about basically a four-month period for the first thing. And there are allegations of really inappropriate touching and then oral sex.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It could happen in August, September, October, November, sometime before December. It seems to me the defendant's position has to be it didn't happen. Any time, any one of those days in the four-month period. Okay, now why does it make a difference that there be more specific date?
Well, Justice Prosser, I would respond to your question by saying part of a defense in a sexual assault case, obviously, is that it didn't happen. But the defense should be able to provide offers of proof in response to the state's allegation. And part of that could be providing an alibi for this couldn't have happened because I wasn't even in town that day. It's impossible that she was molested during August 1st to December 1997 at 4:30 p.m., or I apologize, that would be count two, so June 15th to March 1st, because I didn't work at 4:30. I worked from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., if that's what the facts would show. And so I think the ability to present an alibi or provide business records and employee documentation from where he was working and what hours he was working would be helpful, and that's why we shouldn't have such overly broad charging periods, and especially overly broad charging periods when we're going back 12 and 15 years.
So it's just, there's a denial, but you have to show something.
That's correct.
That's your point. That's the defense. And if there's too broad a period, then there's an issue that additional charges could be brought in that that would subject him to double jeopardy, but you could never show double jeopardy because the period's too broad, so couldn't isolate it.
That's correct. We get into the second prong of wholesome when we're examining this.
I know, but...
Well, I'm not sure how your argument in regard to a test squares with two observations made in the Court of Appeals opinion. And they're very brief, but they have to do, obviously, with Fawcett and RAR, or Wholesome. Judge Gundrum, writing for the Court of Appeals, said, in Fawcett, we stated that a court may look to the first three factors when evaluating the prosecution, whether it was diligent and reasonable. And then similarly, under Wholesome, relevant factors include but are not limited to the last four factors. And it seems to me, and I may be missing something, but it seems to me that your argument almost is reading that as that discretionary language, which is making account for potential scenarios which we can't anticipate, but it seems to me you want to limit the courts to those factors.
Well, what we'd like to do and what we'd like to see is a sound application providing consistent results. And so when we're looking at the final four factors, which the court in Fawcett adopting Morris's factors, which were the final four, what we're really discussing is the courts having discretion to weigh those four factors. It's our contention that those four factors can adequately address whether sufficient notice has been provided in any child sexual assault case.
So you would have us change or interpret the language in Wholesome as being cabined to the seven factors?
The seven factors in child sexual assault cases. The Wholesome test in Wisconsin.
So the answer is yes?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
I don't quite understand this. I thought your argument was looking at the seven factors laid out in Fawcett. One, it seemed to me that that case is not limited to seven, right? It's anything else that could be relevant, right?
Yes.
Pardon me?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so I read that case to really be a totality of circumstances case, with saying here are some key circumstances. So I'm not quite sure what the difference is between test, standard, guidance. You know, to me, they are all the same, regardless of what you use, and the question is, what do they mean? Then my understanding from the briefs was that people read Fawcett to say that the first three factors deal with the issue if there's delay.
the way we... Oh, I apologize.
And the last four factors deal with whether it's delay or not. And I read the state's brief, and I will ask the state this, that they want to overturn RAR because they think that they miss that RAR misinterprets Fawcett about the first three factors. So what do you say about all of that?
Well,
where have I gone astray?
I would argue that Fawcett and RAR are not in conflict, and I think that's one of the areas where the Court of Appeals erred. Fawcett, at the time it was decided, didn't have anything beyond the wholesome analysis, so the two-prong analysis to determine sufficiency. They found People versus Morris, which was the New York case that said there are seven factors to be considered. And in Morris, the first three were to be considered if there was an allegation of lack of diligence on behalf of the prosecutor. And those really go towards whether the charging period could be more narrowly tailored as opposed to sufficient notice to the defendant within the four corners of the complaint. And so we're not saying that in no case should the seven Fawcett factors be applied, but only in cases where there's an allegation of lack of diligence on behalf of the prosecutor in narrowly tailoring the criminal complaint. As to the four factors, we believe those get to the heart of the issue as to whether the defendant is put on notice that's sufficient to be able to allow them to prepare and plead a defense.
And what about RAR? What is that?
I would say RAR is still good law. I would say it's not in conflict with Fawcett, and RAR is affirming Fawcett that there is a distinction in which factors are applied based on the nature of the challenge by the defendant. And so Fawcett said we have seven factors, and in the footnote it included the specific language from Morris, which said the reasonable test analysis is dependent on the allegation by the defendant. And Fawcett affirmed that in its holding.
As I read the defendant's, the state's brief, they want to overturn us, I told you. You know, of course, that the next case we're going to hear, State v. Hurley, has similar issues, different facts, which, of course, is very important. I'm assuming you looked at the Hurley case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I think it would be more appropriately addressed by Hurley, but I will say there is a distinction with these two. Hurley had five acts over 5 years, and there was a six-year delay between the alleged incident and the date of the complaint being filed. In this case, we only have two, which makes it not fall under 948.025. There's no allegation that this was a continuous course of conduct. In fact, the alleged victim states between August 1st to December 1st of 1997. And this isn't actually the alleged victim providing those dates. This is the state, based on her description of the time of year in terms of school, picking dates. But we have one incident that's both factually different and 3 years set apart from the second incident. And so I think there is a distinction to be made, but I would also say that sufficient notice must be provided in both.
So how would you write this opinion if you were writing it to give guidance and clarify all of this? Because after all, every case is a little different on the facts, and what you want to do is set forth I think, maybe the criteria or factors in a totality of circumstances test.
Well, we would have this court affirm RAR in that the nature of the challenge asserted by the defendant does provide the court guidance as to which specific factors should apply. For instance, in Fawcett, there was one count of on or about December 7th, 1985. And it wasn't until the defense was able to provide an alibi that that charging period was enlarged to two counts over 6 months. So I think in that case, there is a clear alleged lack of diligence claim within the four corners of the complaint, and therefore the court correctly applied all seven factors. In this case, we're conceding the state could not have more narrowly tailored this complaint. They took into account all of the statements by the alleged victim. There was a thorough investigation. There just wasn't enough information provided to put the defendant on sufficient notice of the charges against him. So in this case, I would state that because there's no lack of diligence, this court should apply the final four factors in RER.
Do you really, and I know you've been asked this in several different ways, but do you really think that reading Fawcett and reading RAR, there are only seven factors and that's all the court can look at? Or do you think the court can look at other factors as well?
Well, we don't want to limit the court's discretion in these cases, but I do believe that these seven factors more than adequately provide all that a court would need to examine whether sufficient notice has been provided. For instance, the fourth factor, which is the period of the charging and the amount of offenses. So in this case, we have one offense per 4 months in count one and one offense per 3.5 months in count two. When we look at that, what we're looking for is this an overly broad period where the defense could be able to craft an alibi defense? In the fifth and sixth factors, what we're really dealing with is the ability of the defendant to prepare a defense that deals with the dimmed memories. In this case, there's 12 and 15 years between the alleged incidents and the charging. And so for a defendant to be able to craft a defense, he may have to have witnesses that would rebut what the alleged victim claims. And
my problem is this. If you think that it's appropriate for the court to look at any relevant factors, why should automatically the first three factors of Fawcett be excluded because there is no allegation of a lack of diligence? That doesn't make sense to me.
The reason we're arguing this is that the first three factors don't go towards whether the defendant has sufficient notice. Whether they go in favor of the defendant or the state, that deals with whether the complaint and charging period could be more narrowly tailored, whether it could be narrowed down. Whether a alleged victim is 6 years old or 12 years old, which is one of the factors that the court is to look at. In fact, it's factor one. If they're not able to state with particularity the date and time of the offense, sufficient notice is not had and there's a due process violation. So the age of the victim doesn't really go towards sufficient notice. It goes towards whether a prosecutor could be expected to more narrowly tailor this based on the alleged victim's statements.
Well, you think it's serious error, then, if they look at all seven factors and 13 other factors, assuming they're all relevant? I mean, that's another way of asking Justice Crooks's question. I mean, how come that's prejudicial error if you look at the first three?
Well,
there's another way of stating the issue.
The concern we have and what we've seen in multiple decisions is the courts either applying four or applying all seven and then using some of the first factors as to going to the sufficiency of the complaint, which they don't actually do. And so if they take into account that a child who is 6 years old has an inability to recall something that perhaps a 12-year-old child would, and they grant that leniency to the prosecutor, and they let the case go forward, that would still be a due process violation. So it's a serious violation if the court were to look at the first three factors and apply them incorrectly. So apply them to sufficient notice as applying them to being more narrowly tailored.
In this case, the defendant allegedly said to the alleged victim, you have been bad, or words to that effect, thereby discouraging the victim from reporting. Should there be some kind of consequence for that kind of activity, in effect a forfeiture?
Well, I'd first like to clarify what the defendant is alleged to have said is that I was bad. I'll get in trouble if you tell someone. And secondly, the alleged victim in this case actually did tell multiple people years before this came about. She was alleged to have told somebody when she was in eighth grade that she had been molested. So that would have only been 2 years after the second count instead of 12 years. She was also have alleged to have told a boyfriend at the time. And so I think that is an important distinction. But more to your question, when we look at the fifth and sixth factors, which are the passage of time from the incident to the complaint being filed, that is within the court's discretion to consider, is whether the defendant did something to delay the charging. So I think that is already within the court's discretion according to the factors. Also in this case, the stepfather and the mother were divorced in 2005, so 4 years after, yet she still didn't come forward until 2012. So I think that's also important to notice, because then we would be dealing with a four-year delay as opposed to a 12 and 15-year delay.
Counselor, even if you had only a four-year delay, do you really think that your client could say on sometime during this period, she was never available to me when he's a live-in? I don't see how he can mount a defense that's based on collapsing the time like you're arguing to us. I think either that doesn't violate due process, or the time period we have now is as good as the one you're arguing for.
Well, I do think as time passes, it becomes more and more difficult to amount a defense. I will say that even if only 4 years had elapsed and we did have these, I see my red light is on, I'll just finish.
You may finish.
Okay. And we have these 3.5 and 4 months charging periods, it would still be difficult and may rise to the level of insufficiency.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Sarah Burgundy, representing the state of Wisconsin. Ms. Burgundy.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. First, I'd like to just address some of the points that came up in the opening argument. And as it's clear from, I think, our brief, we do believe Fawcett and RAR are in conflict to the extent that RAR limits the courts to the final four factors depending on what the defendant says the problem is with the complaint. We don't believe that the language in the Fawcett footnote supports the RAR court's conclusion, and it just doesn't make sense to eliminate the first three factors. The language in the Fawcett footnote, when talking about looking at a challenge like this, is that you look at the first three factors. If after this exercise the state is found to have exerted diligent investigatory efforts, the charging document should then be examined to determine whether, under the circumstances, the designated period of time set forth is reasonable. So what under the circumstances means, I believe, is that under the circumstances that the court examined under the first three factors. It is a totality of the circumstances test, and there's no significant difference between a claim, or no practical difference really, between a claim that the state wasn't diligent and between a claim that, in general, the charging period is overbroad.
You do agree, though, that the complaint has to be limited in some manner as to time so that the defendant has notice and can muster a defense and can avoid double jeopardy. I mean, you agree. I mean, you just
Absolutely.
Couldn't say between birth and 16 or whatever the age you want to do, she was molested 3 times or 20 times. I mean,
you're right.
There has to be something, right?
Correct.
And and what's before the court is, what is that, quote, something that narrows down the time limit, right?
Right.
And what test do you propose?
Well, what we're asking is for the court to, basically the test is kind of set forth in how the majority of states approach it. It's basically you're looking at,
set forth in what? I'm sorry.
The majority of states that I think it's set forth in the brief that the there's only a minority of states that really use this, these reasonableness factors. But it does square up with the majority approach, which is basically in these sorts of cases, you're going to look at what was before the state in forming the charges, what were the circumstances presented, and do the charges that the state set forth in the time period, are those reasonable given the circumstances the state presented? And then the second consideration is, did this actually prejudice the defendant in an ability to present a defense? And the factors, the reasonableness factors will help the courts answer those questions.
Well, that doesn't give trial courts very much guidance.
Well, those are the touchstones. The guidance comes in where how the factors are applied. So I think in the second part of my brief, I kind of set forth how those factors should be applied in these cases. So if the courts are looking at, again, all the circumstances presented, the age and intelligence of the victim, the surrounding circumstances, the nature of the offense, the ability of the victim to specify the crimes, and take that all into consideration, balance that against, okay, what did the state say? What is the charging period here? Does that make sense based on what the state had available to it? And, you know, that gets to the first part of the question. You know, it makes sense that the best they can narrow it down to is a 3.5-month period on this charge and a 4-month period on this charge. We don't think they can narrow it down any further, and we don't think that the length of the charge is, you know, and then the second part of it goes to, well, what is this actually affecting? And, you know, in many of these cases where, and I would say almost all of these cases, where the victim is accusing a family member, a step-parent, a parent who lived with and had continuous access to the victim over the entire charging period, there's not going to be an alibi defense available. It's going to come down to credibility. Now, there is sort of an incentive built in for the state to narrow the charges down as much as possible, because by virtue of setting forth a broad charging period, and by having a victim who can't remember the dates or can't remember the exact time it happened, that gives the defendant a credibility defense right there, where they can argue, you know, listen, this is a traumatic event for this victim. It doesn't make sense that he or she can't remember a date. And again, it goes to the main challenge, which is in these cases, which is going to be a credibility challenge.
So, is it okay if we just affirm, force it, and take the 7 factors and anything else that comes to the court's mind?
Yeah, and I think what we're advocating is that you affirm Fawcett, but just provide a little additional clarification on how the factors are applied. I think just as an initial matter, as a housekeeping matter, factors 5 and 6 are basically the same and don't really look at different things, and we can maybe merge those into one. So that one looks at, I believe, the original factors, the length of the delay and the arrest and the length of the delay in the indictment. And that maybe can just be merged into the length of the delay between the charges, I'm sorry, between the alleged acts and between the charges. I think advising the courts to kind of avoid the mathematical approach that some of these multi-factor tests might push courts to do, to engage in, I think would be helpful. In a lot of these cases, especially when you get to the fourth factor, looking at the number of charges per time period or the delay, courts tend to look at other cases and where they found a long delay was, you know, too long, or, you know, one delay was too long, another was not so long, and it just gets confusing. So you just, you know, so instead of courts saying, well, in this case, the victim was 5 years old, and it was a 6-month period, and 2 charges, and avoiding that calculus and then just looking at the case itself. Does this all make sense based on what was before the state?
Ms. Burgundy, I'm a little bit concerned about whether or not Fawcett and RAR are really incompatible one with the other. Isn't there some reference made in Fawcett to this idea of diligence, prosecutorial diligence, as is referenced in RAR?
As to prosecutorial diligence? So are you asking if does Fawcett recognize that you could ask about diligence separately from a claim of...
There's reference made, as I remember it, in Fawcett.
Whenever they adopted the factors, they dropped the second footnote, provided the language in Morris, and they said, and it basically said, this is where we got it. And
sure, and that's where it comes from, is the New York case of Morris.
But then if you go to the main text of Fawcett, whenever they say, okay, and we're going to go ahead and adopt the factors, and here are all the factors, they went ahead in that case, and they applied all seven factors, but I did not... In that case, there was not a specific allegation that the state wasn't diligent. It was a motion to make more clear and definite, I believe. So it wasn't – the Fawcett court, in any event, didn't read the Morris footnote to limit itself to the four factors.
So you really think that RAR and Fawcett are somewhat incompatible one with the other and that we should get rid of RAR?
I think RAR creates confusion because it's some courts are deciding to apply only four factors because they feel that they're limited because they didn't see the word diligence or the exact, claim that there was a lack of diligence where the first three factors, there's no need for the first three factors to not be on the table in those sorts of cases.
Wouldn't it just be easier for us to take an approach that I thought was similar to what the Court of Appeals did and say, look, these two cases talk about seven factors. You're not limited to seven factors. You're limited to any relevant factors in the particular case. Isn't that a way of making those two cases somewhat compatible?
I think the trouble is the court in RAR said unless the defendant alleges diligence, you don't. So I think to the extent that RAR has this negative holding of you are limited to these final factors depending on what whether the defendant alleges diligence or not, I think that part of it is incompatible. I think, I think that's it.
So you really want us to say there isn't that kind of limitation. You can consider any factors that under the totality of the circumstances, as the chief was referring to earlier, any factor that's relevant you can consider.
Exactly. And you can leave out any factor if you deem it irrelevant. So it's, you're not, you don't have to go lockstep with these seven factors.
You make reference to the Hurley case in at least two of your footnotes, mm-hmm. Maybe other references, but my attention was called to them. And on page 21, footnote 14, you say the state also urges that this court direct the circuit courts and court of appeals to consider the impact of the repeated nature of the criminal acts. And then you have a paragraph that says, to clarify, the state doesn't endorse different tests for repeated versus single-act assaults. Rather, whether the alleged conduct is continuous should be part of the reasonableness test, as you set forth in Part 2. And then in Part 2, on page 20, in footnote 18, you say the state likewise recommends the courts consider the defendant's available defenses, but does so under factor two of the analysis. That puts it in the first three. The debate is whether the first three are applicable or not. Mm-hmm. Here the state recommends the courts consider available defenses in tandem with factors 4 through 6, so it seems to me as if you're arguing 2 can be synonymous with 4 through 6. Maybe that isn't what you were arguing. The state's overarching point, and this is the one I'm really trying to make, remains that consideration of the defenses should be part of the analysis. And how can the defendant know what his defenses would be to a charging period or charges that he isn't facing? This is my question.
How can a defendant know his defenses?
What his defenses will be when the charging period is huge, large, several months, year.
Right.
And then does he know what the charges are that he's facing? And I'll get to that in Hurley, whether it's 5 charges or 25 charges or 26 right. charges. So, and you make references to Hurley now. Are you referring to the state's brief in this court in your brief? Okay. And these two briefs are consistent in your opinion?
We did our best to make them consistent.
We'll let you
Fortunately,
know.
They're on different schedules, and but yeah. yes.
But that's what
our
I
goal
mean.
Is we're not asking for 2 different standards.
Yeah, because I don't remember seeing in Hurley the state saying, and I could be wrong, that RAR is inconsistent with Fawcett and should be overturned or modified or withdrawn or something. Okay.
And in response to your I think that the question of how do you know the defense is?
Right.
Mm-hmm. There's a few answers to that. First of all, this case happens to be a pretrial challenge. These challenges also come post-conviction. And so obviously, in the post-conviction context, you have everything before you. You know what came in. And I think in those cases, the difference is what you're looking at. The difference is going to be whether you're looking just at the criminal complaint, as you're more or less limited to in pretrial, versus, looking at everything that came in. How do you know your defenses? I think by virtue of the nature of these sorts of cases, of child sexual assault, and when it's involving a defendant who lives with, knows the victim, it's going to come down to, if it's a long charging period, your defenses available is going to come down to the specificity with which the actual acts are alleged. I think that answers, it's going to, more often than not, the challenge is going to be a double jeopardy issue and not notice based on the time. And I think the comment Justice Prosser made earlier about, the availability of an alibi defense to someone in that situation, even if you can bring in business records saying, well, I was somewhere else on that day, the defense is still that it didn't happen. It can't be that, for this brief period of time, I wasn't available. Again, goes to credibility.
Well, we have rules. We have structure of how this criminal justice system works. And this criminal justice system works that the state brings charges and the state has the burden beyond a reasonable doubt to prove the charges. The criminal justice system works that the defendant is not charged with the burden of proving innocence. And so in the confines of those rules, you could advance the argument, the defense should be, I don't care, it can give me 10 years in a charging document, it didn't happen. But that seems to emphasize a defendant's burden that doesn't exist under our rules. Our rules are that the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this occurred during this period of time. What's your response to that?
The state doesn't need to show that time isn't of the essence in these cases. And what that means is that the jury could be put forth with evidence that it occurred within a few months. They all don't need to agree that it occurred on August 1st, 2001, they need to agree that it occurred within a time period.
Yes,
and when time isn't of the essence, the state doesn't need to state it with specificity, especially in child sexual assault cases where it's been long recognized that the child doesn't remember exact dates. There's going to be inherent difficulty in presenting an exact date, and especially in recent years when the statute of limitations has been so greatly expanded, we're going to have way more cases with decades passing between the alleged act and the time period. And what this all goes to, and I don't mean to run over you. What it all goes to is, you know, the longer the period that the state alleges that these occurred, and the fewer number of charges, that all again is strength. It goes to the a credibility defense for the defendant of saying, you know, he can go to the jury and say, listen, the state, this victim doesn't remember the date. I'm expected to defend myself against 10 years worth of charges. It's in the state's interest to narrow them down as much as possible, and in the end, it gives, that's sort of the trade-off here. We allow more flexibility in these cases, and it also gives the defendant a credibility.
Certainly, time is not of the essence, as you state, but how do you keep that argument and that premise of law from morphing into, well, it could have happened any time? I mean, in other words, the defendant is put on almost a limitless burden of defense. Life is full of line drawings, and law is full of line drawings. And although clearly, especially in child sexual assault cases, as you advance in terms of time, isn't necessarily of the essence, but it doesn't morph into, so therefore time makes no difference.
And we're not saying that at all. There's definitely built-in protections for that. There's a statute of limitations, so certainly if the time period will then exceed the statute of limitations for making the claim, that would be a limitation. The bigger thing is, most of these charges are for a claim of child sexual assault against a child of a certain age. So if the child's at a different age, then, if the charging period puts the child into the next bracket of age, that would certainly limit it. And in most of these situations, there are situations where the child lived with the perpetrator their entire lives, but there's going to be also other factors. There was a specific period they were living together. And again, it goes to the specificity of the charges and the child's ability to say when this happened. Many times the child can say where it happened, and they could say, okay, when we were living in this house in Sheboygan in this year, it comes again to the ability the victim to specify the charges, and that also works to limit the time periods. But in no way are we advocating just, say time is not of the essence and do away with time periods whatsoever. We're still advocating that prosecutors should narrow them down as much as possible and, keep it reasonable within what information they have from the victim.
Counsel, I would like to ask you a question that your opposing counsel had been asked earlier. If you had the opportunity to write the holding of this opinion, what would it be? And I'm particularly curious because in response to Justice Crooks's questions, it seems to me that the rule you're urging upon us is to say, when those opinions, when Fawcett and Holsom said, you are not limited to a consideration of these factors, we meant that a court can consider any relevant factor. Now, if I'm missing something or misstating something, please, I stand to be corrected, but that's why I would like to know your response to that question.
So if I was writing a holding for this case, it would write first, to the extent that RAR and Fawcett conflict, to the extent that RAR is saying you are limited to these four factors.
That's the least of my concerns.
Okay, good. The second part is we're endorsing the Fawcett approach and providing just additional guidance and suggestions on how that applies and reiterating that any relevant factors are on the table.
Well, I think the holding, then, is that last phrase that you said. And I think this is what I picked up from one of your responses to Justice Crooks. Fawcett, Holsom, plus any relevant consideration.
Correct.
Okay.
It just seems, though, the real part of your argument, and I may have missed it, is that when you have this totality of circumstances test, which you're promoting, that the courts are applying this totality of circumstances test very differently from case to case. Anyway, that's what I think your brief says, and you looked at per curiams and published opinions and unpublished opinions, and they, now I'm saying something you didn't say, you're all over the map, and you want to gather some consistency, and that's what I gathered. And then part two of your brief is designed to promote that kind of consistency, and starting at page 29 and thereabouts, 28. So you have on page 28, here is how you, below, the state addresses the reasonableness factor and applies them to the facts using the following approach. And you got two approaches. And then the rest of your brief details that. Because what your objection is, as I understand the briefs, is that that the totality of circumstances approach provides a wide range and that you don't think the circuit courts and court of appeals are consistent in the cases. Now, have I overstated your position?
And let me clarify that. I think that the main inconsistency with how the circuit courts and court of appeals have been applying the reasonableness factors is that they're either reading RAR as controlling and applying only four,
okay,
or they're saying, or they're looking to Fawcett and they're applying all seven. Now, in terms of when the courts are applying all seven and any other relevant factors, they're not going too far. They're basically honoring Fawcett, and that's not an inconsistent application. I would say there are just a few tweaks within that I would encourage this.
What are the tweaks?
The tweaks are basically, the main thing is the treatment of factors four and five and kind of that mechanical, mathematical approach and saying, in this other case, we said this time period was too long, but in this case, we said this was fine, and this is closer to that case when you're just looking at the age of the victim, the number of assaults, the time period, and the delay. I think that reduces the analysis to, you know, it just reduces it to a mathematical equation that doesn't take in, it sort of disregards the totality of circumstances.
Well, that's page 34 of your brief. You say fourth, fifth, and sixth factors require consideration of the first three and the impact on defenses available. And your second full paragraph says, courts need clarification on how to apply these factors. Currently, they tend to weigh long charging periods and delays automatically in defendants' favor. That's inappropriate. So rather, you want them, in weighing these three factors, that's fourth, fifth, and sixth, to consider and balance their analysis of the first three and consider whether the charging period or delay actually prejudiced the defendant by preventing him from asserting an otherwise reasonably available defense. So your position is the defendant has to show a reasonably available defense, and then the judge can decide how the factors fit. I mean, that's just the opposite. We don't require the defendant to do anything. I mean, that goes back to Justice Bradley's question.
Sure, and I think if the defendant is bringing a motion to say my due process rights were violated, I think to obtain relief, he or she needs to show how they were violated. I had this defense and I couldn't raise it, and what that defense is. And in this case, Mr. Kempinen didn't raise any, you know, just basically said it limited me in my ability to prepare a defense, but we don't know what that is. You know, an argument he's discussed, you know, the availability of alibi, but I think as I discussed earlier, in most, if not all, of these cases where it's a resident defendant, that's not going to be an available defense.
You sort of, again, make a depending on the circumstances argument in how you apply it. This is all goes to application in the second full paragraph of page 35 of your brief. Court should reflexively weigh the broad charging periods and long delays. So although you say you want to give them guidance, the guidance is to give them more discretion. When I say discretion, more factors to consider and apply them.
Well, really the only additional factor, if you could phrase it as or call it that, is the available defenses.
What was that?
The only additional factor would be what additional defenses are available. Let me also add consider whether it's a continuous course of conduct versus single acts. I think that would come in too. But the guidance is more toward, how are you looking at factors 4 and 5? You're looking at them in balance with the first 3 plus 7 factor when you're looking at the circumstances of the case, the age, intelligence, the nature of the charges, not going outside and saying, not going down the road of developing a bright line rule of how long is too long and, how short is sufficient and that kind of thing. So.
Well, I thought you had said it earlier that what you're arguing is, in your understanding, an extension or an interpretation of Fawcett include but is not limited to.
Exactly. And these are just, again, of course, this isn't a mandate. You must do all factors at all times, but it's, encouraging the courts to look at these other things. I don't know if I have anything additional to add, so unless there are more questions.
I'll ask a question. We talk about RAR in the abstract, and I want to look at the language of RAR.
Okay.
And maybe I'll visit that question on someone else. I see your red light is up. I can do that through another opportunity. Thank you.
Okay. Well, and just may I conclude briefly?
Just quickly.
We're asking this court to affirm the Court of Appeals, and in doing so, we're asking that you overrule RAR and clarify Fawcett. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
So I would like to start by saying that what the state has done is frame the issue for the first prong of their test as whether the charging period was reasonable considering the 7 factors listed in Fawcett. And I think that's a misstatement of the issue because in these cases, we're not looking at the reasonableness of how the state filed the charging period. What we're looking at is whether it provided sufficient notice. So to go back to something Justice Crooks had said, if an alleged victim was able to provide with great specificity the conduct that they're alleging against the defendant, but are unable to provide a time period that provides sufficient notice, it would still be a violation of that defendant's due process rights. And a second thing I'd like to address is the issue of flexibility. There are inherent difficulties in prosecuting child sexual assault cases. And the legislature, in enacting 948.025, acknowledged that. They made a finding that these inherent difficulties make it more difficult to prosecute, and they don't want to hold children to a burden of being able to say with specificity each act alleged on each date over a period of time. Because if a child were living with someone who was abusing them, over years, it's unreasonable to expect a child to say with specificity each and every event in detail, including the time of the offense. This case is distinguishable. The legislature has drawn a line at 3 or more acts. Here we have 2 that are separated temporally. The legislature also has greatly increased the statute of limitations in child sexual assault cases to when, I believe now, it's the victim is 45 years old. But there still must be a finding that sufficient notice has been provided so that the defendant has the ability to prepare a defense. And so that's the issue in this case. Another thing we're looking at in this is the state's contention that the defendant must be able to demonstrate some sort of compromise to their ability to present a defense. And I think that's burden shifting and inappropriate in this case.
What's the burden shifting that you see?
Well, I think if we do an examination of the Fawcett or RAR factors and there's a finding that it's either unreasonable, what the state wants to do is then have the defendant demonstrate some sort of prejudice based on that in their ability to present a defense. And especially in this case where it's a pretrial motion, shortly after the preliminary hearing, if it's found insufficient, it should end there because we're talking about a due process violation. And if it's a violation of the Sixth Amendment, the defendant shouldn't then have to prove, okay, I don't have sufficient notice, and because of that, I'm unable to present a defense. And so I think the test should remain whether sufficient notice was provided. If there's insufficient notice, the case should be dismissed.
I don't think you're going to find an argument with that. If insufficient notice is provided, then it should be dismissed. But what we're trying to work on, as you identified in the beginning of your rebuttal argument, is what are the factors that our courts are supposed to use? And in when we spoke earlier, you said, I think, that the seven factors that have been enumerated are sufficient. And will you remind me, please, which factor or factors are insufficient here, provided the difficulty, the unreasonableness?
Yes, Your Honor. The circuit court found that the fourth factor didn't favor either side. Our contention is that if there's two distinct acts and there's a four-month charging period for that one act, that is insufficient notice, especially because that was based off of the alleged victim's statement that she was at the beginning of second grade. She said she was between 6 and 7 years old when we know with her date of birth she would have actually been 8 years old at the time. That's a rather large time period, especially in comparison to other cases. As for the fifth and sixth factors, I think it's clearly in favor of Mr. Kempinen. We're talking about 12 and 15 years in delay. We know, according to the alleged victim, that she had told several other people prior to these charges being filed that this had occurred. Had this happened closer temporally, there would be a little bit less of an issue, although I think there still would be one.
So it's the conflicting evidence in regard to the alleged time period versus the actual age plus the length of time equals unreasonable notice.
And if I may, I have the red light. But finally, the seventh factor, there is a great lack of specificity and particularization as to the date and time of the offense as opposed to the conduct. Thank you.
Thanks.
Strikes me that way you and the state differ is that you think that the unreasonableness can be defined by looking at the complaint, looking at the circumstances. The state, in applying this, the factors and tests, in several places say, hey, it's reasonable unless the defendant shows prejudice, and you don't agree that at least at this pre-trial stage, the defendant has to show prejudice in order to knock out that complaint.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's a key difference between you?
Yes, I do. I think that at this stage, there should only be a finding of whether sufficient notice is provided, and that has to be limited to the four corners of the complaint. I believe if insufficient notice is provided, the complaint should be dismissed. It's not whether the prosecutor reasonably applied what they were told by the alleged victim, but whether that in turn provided sufficient notice so that the defendant could prepare and plead the defense.
Thank you, counsel.
As you pointed out, before you sit down, as you pointed out, the legislature has given alleged victims up until the age of 45 to be a complaining witness in a criminal complaint. So therefore, it must have been contemplated that there would be these lengthy time periods, 12, 15 years, up till age 45. So if it happened when the child was 6, there could be a 39-year period. How does your argument in regard to the 12 to 15 years delay in this case square with the idea that they have up until age 45 to bring the complaint?
Sure. Well, there was a case before the court, I apologize, I believe it was State versus McGuire, where there was actually a 36-year. Yes. And in that case, it dealt with multiple victims. There was an allegation of a continuous course of conduct. They were specific as to the season, as to when it began, as to when it ended. And there were business records in that case because it involved a religious organization that held records that long. And so I think in that case, although it is a great length of time, there was the ability, there were other witnesses available.
Verification of particular allegations.
That's correct, which is lacking in this case.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank counsel for the state and for the defendant for their arguments in State versus Kempinen, raising an issue the court has seen before in different circumstances on the sufficiency of a complaint. And we're going to proceed to the next case, which is going to talk about similar issues in different fact situations. So thank you both. That concludes our hearing in 13 AP 1531 CR, State versus Brian S. Kempinen. We'll take a short recess so that the students may leave and that counsel for the next case may take the podium. We're in recess.